Les cours du Collège de France, Histoire du monde indien, Gérard Fussman.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, today the two lectures will be in English. So I beg your pardon for my broken English, but being French, you will understand me, I suppose. So I was telling you last week that before 1924, the picture of the population of India was quite simple. Before, let us say, 1500 BC, there were only savages speaking Dravidian languages and Munda languages, and around 1500 BC, the Arya came in, Arya being the name which the population who had for, let us say, for main book the Rig Veda, and also the Iranians, whose main prayer book was the Avesta, gave to themselves. And at the time it was thought that Arya meant that Arya was the name of all the Indo-European populations, and since the 19th century they were called in most books Aryans, with the consequence, you know, for the Nazi ideology in Germany. So that was quite simple. There were on one side wild tribes, and on the other very civilized warriors who were our ancestors. They came into India, they conquered it, and they pushed down southward the Dravidian, and they established the Indian civilization. So that, in a sense, they were our cousins. That was the way our colleagues, the scholars of the 19th century, so-called Orientalists, called them up to 1850. They were called our far-off cousins in the same way as Sanskrit, Greek and Latin were told to be sister languages. So the British... Ah, alors il faut demander à... Vous avez raison de le dire, mais il faut le demander à la régie. Voilà. Qui va le faire, j'en suis sûr. That picture is now outdated, but it was quite important at the time. And most of the 19th century history of India depends on that picture of the history of the population of India. And for instance, we just published a book by Mrs. Bhattacharya, which you may see here, about three leading Bengali intellectuals of the 19th century, Ram Mohan Roy, Budev, and Bankim Chatterjee, and all believed in that pictures. And some believed that the Arya were degenerated people, or degenerated Indo-Aryans, mainly the Brahmins. Some believed that they could be rehabilitated, and so he believed they had not to be changed, but they had that picture in their mind that the Indian population came, at least the upper classes, came directly from the Indo-Aryan invaders, and that before there was nothing in India. That picture changed dramatically with the discovery in 1924 and with the subsequent excavation of Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro. You can see here an aerial view of Mohenjo-Daro. And Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa are in Punjab, where not only the European scholars, but also the Indian scholar tells that the Rig Veda was composed. That was the heart of Aryan India. So in the heart of Aryan India were discovered two towns huge town for the time. They were some of the most populated town for the second millennium BC, from 35,000 inhabitants to 60,000 inhabitants. And these towns had considerable amenities, sophisticated agricultures. Remember that the so-called Arians were herdsmen. They had a bristling trade with Iraq, with Sumer, where they found very early Harappan artifacts, and it seems they knew writing. When the Aryan did not know any writing, and the invention of writing of India is to be dated a bit before Ashoka, either under Chandragupta or under the father of Ashoka, Bindusara, that means in the 4th century AD. So that was quite a new picture of India which came in, and the scenario which was written by European scholars had to be changed. It was changed by Sir Mortimer Wheeler. Sir Mortimer Wheeler was a British archaeologist sent in 1944 to India to try to revigorate the archaeological survey of India, which was in very bad shape at that time. And like Cunningham, he was also a general. There was a difference between Alexander Cunningham and Wheeler. Cunningham began his career as a general. First he became general, and later maybe the best archaeologist in India. Sir Mortimer Wheeler was an archaeologist of the British island, specialized in prehistory and in Roman history. But he was a soldier at heart, and during the Second World War, he was made a brigadier general and sent to India, where he reorganized the Archaeological Survey of India, which is still functioning like along the lines set by Sir Mortimer Wheeler. And the main thrust of Mortimer Wheeler's activities in India were his two hobbies, prehistory, hence Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro, and Roman history, hence a great preoccupation with Gandharan art. So he had to write for the Cambridge History of India a chapter on this new discovery and the subsequent dig he made in these towns. And the changes were minor because Sir Mortimer Wheeler had the same kind of imagination as his predecessor. He was quite British and quite soldier. So the scenario became our five cousins, the Indo-Aryans, not yet debilitated by the Capuan pleasures of urban civilization, laid by their warlike kings and priests, thanks to their superior and military organization, destroyed entirely in this town, which were inhabited by Dravidian-speaking peoples, killed everybody there, and pushed into the Indian jungles. The few survivors went to only resource to go south and elaborate there an entirely new civilization, which after a few centuries would be quite Aryanized again. And and during that time, that means in the first millennium BC, the Indo-Aryan civilization covered the whole atlas of northern India, imposed its language, imposed its lifestyle, which was inherited from Indo-European times, and the urban civilization came after in India, only after more than a millennium, that means in the 6th or 7th century BC. That picture, although outdated for many decades now, is still the prevalent one. It does not fit at all traditional Hindu, who claim that the Harappan towns were Sanskrit speaking and that Vedic civilization is autochthonous in India, only damaged by the advent of foreign uncivilized tribes in the same way as it was later endangered by Muslim and British invasion. You have to understand, to go back to a topic which I told about last week, that the problem of language is quite important in India, much more than the problem of Latin and Greek in France. The classical language of India, Sanskrit, is linked closely to Vedic Sanskrit, that means to the language of the Rig Veda. The Rig Veda is a text which is said to be eternal, not to have been written by anybody, not even by a god, and which gods and seers have seen. That's the etymology of Rig Veda. So, if you say that the Aryans came in an empty India and brought with them Sanskrit and the Rig Veda, that can go, because it was empty. It was empty, and they brought with them their language, and that would be the language of the Brahmin and the Kshatriya of the upper classes of classical India. The Indians of the 19th century were quite glad with that picture. When you say that these people were less civilized than the one who inhabited previously India, it does not that does not go. So you have to take two attitudes. The first is to say, so they came later, but they were much better, and they brought in the eternal language and the eternal literature, if I can say so, of the Rig Veda to India. And hence, India is, at least for its upper classes, purely Indian. The other lower classes are the descendants of the autochthonous people, and that explains that they are in a lower position. That's the position of many Indians even today. The people who are in so-called lower positions are mainly now the people, or are supposed to be the people who inhabit southern India, who speak Dravidian languages like Tamil, Malayalam, Telugu, and Karnataka. and the language of Karnataka. These people, in the 19th century, were not quite happy to be said to be a descendant of savages. With the discovery of Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro, they claimed to be the descendant of the very much more civilized people of Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro. And so that you have two way of trying to decipher the Indus inscription, one from Sanskrit, and which is the preferred by northern Indians, and one from Dravidian languages, which is preferred by southern Indians. And the British prefer still another solution, that means deciphering it from the Sumerian languages. So it's really a fight on the identity of the Dravidian peoples and the northerners in India. And it can go very far. Now it's a subject of political battle between the BJP and other parties in India, and some Indians are trying to solve the conundrum by saying that there is no Dravidian language. All these Dravidian languages, in fact, are Sanskrit languages which are a bit degenerate. But still, in India, they are fighting about in their head the idea that the Aryans came in or were ever in India. Some believe that they came in and destroyed the Harappan town. Some believe that they were ever in India, and that's the basis of the BJP ideology. And to solve the problems of BJP leaders, as I told you, tell that the Dravidian language indeed do not exist, they are only a kind of Sanskrit. The problem for some of these ideologues is that now the two more important towns, that means Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro, are in Pakistan, which is no more part of India. So one of the way to solve the problem which was found was to call it the Indus-Sarasvati civilization, the Sarasvati being a sacred river which has disappeared and which some believe to be able to trace, and some believe it never existed, but at least if it to be traced, it's in today northern India. So by adding the name Sarasvati, you make the Indus civilization no more Pakistani, but purely Indian. So it's a fine way, because it's much better that to claim that Pakistan is really India and to create a kind of irredentism which would lead to war. There are still too many reasons for wars to exist or to break out between Pakistan and India, so there is no reason to add still the existence of the Indus civilization. The picture is now quite different. And the main problem is that very few Indians are aware of it, because most of the data is published in German, in Russian, and in French, as you know that our colleague in India very seldom know French, Russian, and German. They almost only know Indian. There is also a problem which I will not dwell into today, of comparative grammar. Comparative grammar of Indo-Aryan languages is a European subject, American and European subject, which is not talked in many universities, almost not talked even in Britain. That's mainly French, German, Italian, and American, and a few Russians. And a great number of the solutions or the hypotheses which are put forth to explain that civilizations suppose a good knowledge of comparative grammar. I shall not enter into the detail of chronology, which rests on a large number of carbon 14 datations for archaeological artifacts, and on assumptions mainly based on Near Eastern textual evidence for the date of the Indo-Iranian migrations. It seems quite sure now that the decay of Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro, first, we know, thanks to the excavation made after 47, that the area of the Indus civilization was much bigger than previously known. For instance, you have huge settlements dug out since 1950 by the Indians in northern India, in Kalibangan. You have another huge settlement dug out in Gujarat, in Lotal, also by the Indians. Lotal is well published, Kalibangan is almost not published. Dozens of other settlements have been dug out also, and we know now that there were not only huge towns, not only two huge towns with a theory of an empire, a united empire with two capitals, but there were many more towns, and the theory of a united empire does not stand out. And you know that we know that there was an expansion, and we know that there were villages, and we know that the Indian civilizations went south much more than it was previously thought, especially in Gujarat, at least up to Deccan. And now they are searching links between that kind of civilization and the civilization which is found at the same time in southern India. But the thing, the most important, is that the decay of Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro, averred by many 14 carbon datations, took place much earlier than the advance of the area into Punjab, which is now dated from as I told you, Near Eastern textual evidence, sometime between 1500 and 1400 BC. In other words, the area did not bring about the disappearance of the Indus civilization, which was decaying and almost dead when they came in Punjab. The linguists knew since the 30s, and they know since a paper by Jules Bloch, and they know much better since the 60s by a series of papers by Joseph Elfenbach, that the Dravidian Brahui language, which was the main testimony of Dravidian presence in the north, in northern Punjab, indeed is a late comer in Sindh and Balochistan. I may maybe explain you with a small sketch which is a problem. Around 1850, Caldwell established the language of the South, did not belong to the Indo-European group, but were a special group which was called Dravidian, that means Southern. And since up to, let us say, the paper by Bloch, if you look to India, you had a map which was something like that. Here you had Dravidian languages. Here you have the language brought in by the Indo-Europeans, which is called Indo-Aryan, and which may be said to derive from Sanskrit. And here you have a number of languages spoken by wild tribes, which are called the Munda languages. So, when it was, so in the first hypothesis, without the knowledge of Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa, that was quite easy to see that the Indo-Aryan came from the north, and pushed south, pushed to the west, and covered the wood of northern India. And we know they are still pushing that way because quite a number of the words in the Dravidian language are coming from Sanskrit, and the religion is coming for part of it, at least from the Rig Vedic religion. When Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa were discovered, it was quite easy to change the picture and to say So the whole of India was populated by Dravidian people, and we have an evidence that here in Balochistan there is a small language which is called Brahui, small language that means about 60,000 people who speak it, and who are also, most of them are also speaking Baluchi. So these Brahui who are speaking a Dravidian language, they are the last remnant of the Dravidian languages which existed here before the advent of the Indo-Aryans. So you can make the conclusion that Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro were Dravidian-speaking towns, and that Harappa, Mohenjo-Daro, Lothal, which is somewhere there, and Kalibangan somewhere there, were Dravidian-speaking towns. That is still the thing that most people in India believe. But it was shown in around 1930 by Jules Bloch, who was teaching here, by using the Linguistic Survey of India of Griesen, and 60 by a German who was working in Cambridge and who stayed a number of years in Quetta. It was shown that the Brahui language indeed was linked with two groups of Dravidian languages speaking close to the Munda people in the east of India. And it could be shown that by historic evidence that it can first to Sindh and then to Balochistan around the 10th century, not BC, but AD. So if Brahui is a latecomer, you have no evidence at all that Harappan and Mohenjo-Daro towns were speaking Dravidian languages. And indeed, my colleague Witzel, who is now teaching in Harvard and who is following the example of his master Kuiper, his colleague Kuiper, who was teaching in Leiden, they are trying to discover in the Rig Veda dozens of words which are not of Indo-Aryan origin, which are not of Dravidian origin, which are not of Munda origin. And the conclusion, which now seems obvious, even if all the hypotheses put forth by Witzel and Kuiper do not stand water, the conclusion that in Punjab, when the Indo-Aryans came in, there were many languages which have still disappeared, like so many languages. And we know also that the Indo-Aryan people who came into India were not a unified people, and they spoke also dialects. So the picture is a bit more difficult than usually told, and the picture you will get in the handbooks published till now. An analysis of the Rig Vedic hymn shows that they refer to wandering groups of herdsmen and warriors with little knowledge of agriculture and settled life in villages. So it was assumed that having crossed uninhabited Central Asiatic deserts, they learned agriculture from the indigenous peoples of Punjab. Things have now dramatically changed since the excavation made in Turkestan for 25 years. Indeed, they were begun by the Soviet about 40 years ago. Indeed, in the 50s, that means now 60 years ago, but the main results were discovered by Sarianidhi since the 60s. Sarianidhi, who spoke ici. You may see here a map made by my colleague from the École Normale Supérieure of Iran and northern India with Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa. So I did not talk about the discovery of Mergar, but which it's also quite important. It demonstrates that the Indus civilization began in the 7,000 millennium, in the 7 millennium BC, and is indigenous in India. Well, that's not my point, but if you look at that map, and if you wonder how Indo-Aryan tribes could enter India, there are only two ways, either through Bactria, crossing the Hindu Kush and coming into Gandhara, where it seems we have archaeological remains from that time, and especially in Pirak, here also, which was excavated by the Jarij, or they may come that way through Kandahar, through Quetta. These are still the two main roads. Of course, they can have taken so many passes which are there, but the two main roads were that one. These two main roads suppose that they came through this huge desert, the Karakum Desert and the other desert, and here they could not have practiced agriculture. And we know that at that time, in the north, where they are supposed to come from, they were not either practicing agriculture, they were herdsmen. And when you look into the Rigvedic hymns, you can see that there is almost not a word about agriculture. Only they are only speaking about cows, goats, and pastures and razia of cattle. So they were supposed not only not to know agriculture, but not to know any settled life. And up to the 60s, that place was an archaeological desert, like that one in Afghanistan, because in Afghanistan there were the French excavators since 1924, but they were not at all interested in prehistoric times. They were interested only in Greek times, so, and later in Kushan times. So they did not make any research about any prehistoric civilization in Bactria. For the Soviets, it was something else, because since the beginning, they were trying to work on an hypothesis which was very fashionable in Soviet time. That means the ethnogenesis of people. That means the way people become people. And for that, they were looking at prehistoric remains. And they first began along the Kopet Dag here. That strip yellow. Indeed, it's only 10 kilometers wide. It's the only part when you can have a number of settlements. That is the desert. And from the Kopet Dag, they came here in Margiana, where Sarianidhi was Greek by birth, but Soviet by passport, dug out quite a number of settlements, the more important being Gonur, which you may see here. And Gunur is not very big. It's a square, as you may see. There are many others like that. Huh? That's the best. But I know at least five or six like that. And you may see the side is about 150 meters or 200 meters. But that's quite. These are the remains of developed urban civilization with remains of agriculture and quite a sophisticated agriculture using water coming from the Margab, the river of Margiana. And the date is now given surely by a number of carbon 14 datation, and it was flourishing in the third and the early second millennium BC. Sorry, the date now told by the archaeologists are about 2500 BC up to 1700 BC. You know, if you are not an archaeologist, you should know that all the datation which are given by carbon 14 analysis are doubtful. If you have only one, it's very doubtful. If you have two, it may be doubtful. So you need to get quite a number of analysis to be sure. Now we have about 60 datation given by the laboratories, and you can take the most extreme one, which are entirely wrong, but in the middle you are quite sure, because it's a kind of statistic that most of the samples date back to 200 to a time between 250 BC and 1700 BC. And we have also links with Sumer, links with northern Syria, links in trade with the Persian Gulf, and quite a series of settlements which you find the same settlement, not towns so beautiful, but at least exactly the same pottery, which is so important for datation. These people used to be buried with dozens of pots, very fine pots, which there is a series of them in the Louvre Museum, which you can see easily. And the same pots are found in Margiana there, in Tilia Tepe, in Bactrian, and up to there in Shortugai. So you have a huge civilization there, which the Americans call Bactro-Margiana complex, archaeological complex, BMAC, because you have the Bactria and Margiana, and which our colleague Henri-Paul Francfort called the Oxus civilization, because it's along the Oxus River. There are also a number of settlements here in southern Uzbekistan. So if you want to know more, as I am making an advertisement now, you may see the book we published in about 10 years ago. About 10 years ago. Oh no, not 10 years ago, 5 years ago, on Arya, Aryan and Iranian Asia Central, which was up to date at that time, which is now no more exactly up to date, but still that could be a good introduction. And there are a number of papers which can easily be read. There is also one paper which is for very specialized, but most of the paper you can understand them. So this Oxus civilization, which is or BMAC if you prefer, was linked with the great contemporary civilization of Mesopotamia. They found a number of seals from Sumerian origin. It was quite linked with the civilizations of the Iran Plateau and with the Indus Valley. Artifacts coming from the Indus Valley were found in Gonur, and many implements were the same in the Indus civilization of that time, the mature Harappan, and in Gonur. And as instance of that interaction, we may point to the existence of a Harappan settlement in Shortugai in northeastern Afghanistan, the one dug out by Henri Paul Francfort, and to the quite plausible suggestions which was made by two different scholars independently a few years ago, that the famous Mohenjo-Daro bust, which you see in every book on the Indus civilization, and which is supposed to be the bust of a priest king, is indeed an import from some workshop of the Oxus civilization, and or, as it seems to be unfinished, it was carved out probably in Punjab by some craftsman trained in the Oxus civilization. I can tell you briefly which are the reasons of that identification now proposed by Possel and Henri Paul Francfort. That's because we have now many silver implements from the Oxus civilization, which show exactly that type of people with that type of face and that type of clothes with embroidery or something like that. So if we go back at the map, Attendez, on va. Oh, je vais ranger ça, Eric, ne vous inquiétez pas. If we go back at the map, you may easily see that the Indo-Aryans coming to India either took a plane or had to cross a foot the territory of the Oxus civilization. There was no other way. See, there was another way that was to cross that desert, which is quite a desert, and it's quite difficult to see how people pushing cows with in front of them could cross the Iranian desert. If they crossed Margiana and Bactria in the beginning of the second millennium BC, and the date is almost certain now thanks to the Mitanni data and other data, we cannot assume that before entering Punjab, they never encountered towns, they never encountered villages, they never encountered clay buildings, and they did not know anything about irrigations, anything about fields. It's quite sure that coming there, that when coming in India, the Indo-Aryan knew something on the very developed urban civilizations of Near East and of Margiana and Bactria. And it goes so far that my colleague Witzel and Lubotsky, that's always the Leiden school, have even made a list of Sanskrit words of non-Indo-European origin, which relate either to agriculture, to animals like the lion, or to building, for instance, the bricks, which may have been borrowed from the still unknown languages of the Oxus civilization. So, if the description of this is much discussed now by people who are interested in the Indo-Europeans, there were quite a number of books by Renfrew and by Mallory and so on, but they are mainly interested in what happened in Bactria. That means how in the problem of how Indo-Aryans and Iranians coming to Bactria and Mariana with their herds without any knowledge of agriculture, how they could encounter that civilization, pass and go farther south to cross the mountains to enter later India, and forgot everything about that kind of civilization. So that's not my problem. I have, I suppose, an answer. The first is that even if you see on the picture on the screen Greek big cities, these countries were not populated at all. They were almost desert. There were only a few people. For instance, in the second millennium BC, in Punjab, there could have been 200,000 or 300,000 people. So 300,000 people, now you have more than probably 100 million people. So there was as much space as you wanted, and they could pass not through, but on the border, and only exchange a number of goods with the people of the towns, like, for instance, the Pashtun settlers did in northern Bactria in the beginning of the 20th century. So that's a problem. That's a problem which can be solved. The other problem is how they could cross the mountain, which is a bit more difficult. But what is most interesting is that if the description of material life as deduced from the Rig Vedic evidence is not congruent with established facts. That means that the Indo-Aryans knew perfectly what the towns were and what agriculture was. That means that the Rig Veda is no more a trustworthy source for reconstructing the history of Punjab in the late second millennium BC. The more so, because it has been pointed out for long, at least since the 19th century, that some hymns of the Rig Veda, or the nucleus of some hymns, may date back to a time when the Aryas were still wandering north of the Hindu Kush mountains. There is quite a number of geographical names which you find in the Rig Veda, the Rig Veda is supposed to have been composed, as they say, put together in Punjab. But you have quite a series of names which refer to this river in it. And it's quite possible that some of these hymns and at least the nucleus of them could have been composed in Iran, and even that Vasishta, for instance, one of the main composers of Rig Vedic hymn, was an Iranian. So, if these hymns have been composed in Bactria, in northern Afghanistan, or even in Iran, in the middle of the second millennium BC, they cannot be used anymore to describe the life in northern India, in Punjab, in the first millennium BC or in the middle of the second millennium BC. And we may also suppose that the non-Vedic characteristic of some early Indian conception, for instance Shiva, are not necessarily borrowings from the indigenous Indian peoples, the Arya vanquished or assimilated, but they are Aryan's ideas which never found place in the Rig Veda. In other words, you can tell it that way. There are quite a number of deities which you find in later Hinduism, for instance Shiva, which are not known in that way, in the Rig Veda, or which are known under another name and with other characteristics, like, for instance, Rudra for Shiva. There are two solutions. The first is to say that a huge part of the Rig Veda is lost. And if we had it, we could trace the origin of these Hindu gods into the Rig Veda. That's what the Indian believe, most of the Indian believe. There is a second solution, which was very fashionable some times ago, which is to say that these deities indeed are deities from Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa, and try to identify them on seals, on Harappan and Mohenjo-Daro seals. For instance, at the time it was very fashionable to say that Shiva was depicted on Harappan seals till my colleague Doris Srinivasan demonstrated that was not possible. And the third solution now is that if we know that the evidence of the Rig Veda is not full, is not complete, and it does not correspond to what the Indo-Aryans knew and what the Indo-Aryans did, we may also suppose that the ideology of the Rig Veda, as we have it, is also only a part of the ideology of the Indo-Aryans when they came into India, so more so because they did not come together. They came divided into many groups, that these groups were fighting together, and that some of these groups, which were speaking Indo-Aryan languages in the Rig Veda, are called un-Aryans, non-Aryans. They are, in a way, excommunicated. So the Rig Veda would show you only one part of the Aryan ideology, the other having been destroyed because the people were vanquished. But that ideology remained in part, and later you have evidence for it with these so-called non-Indo-Aryan gods. The problem goes much... So the book I show you 5 minutes ago, Stop at this. Since there were new developments, the new developments about the Rig Veda and the Rig Vedic periods come from scholars who are studying the Avesta. You may know that if there is no much progress in the knowledge of the Rig Veda and Vedic text now for about 50 years, indeed, since the death of Louis Renou, there is not much new about it, only some etymologies or something like that. Our Iranian colleagues, that means colleagues who are dealing with Iranian studies, are very active. It's a wonder how many good scholars are in this field and how much they are working. And since about 50 years now, or 60 years, there was a great change in Avestic studies. A new way to look at to the main text of ancient Iranian, that means the Avesta, with colleagues working mainly in Europe and formerly pupils of a German scholar whose name is Hoffman. And of course, what they tell is quite contrary to what their colleagues were not talked by Hoffman are saying, and there is a big fight between Iranicists. Till now, up to now, the pupils of Hoffman seems to hold the end. They were Humbar in Mainz. There is now my colleague Kellens here. You have in Liège Pirard. And probably one of the best is in Harvard, it's Chervaux, with a Swede by birth. And working on the Avesta, they believe, as it was known since the 19th century, that they may see that the language of the Avesta is quite close to the language of the Rig Veda. Indeed, the Avesta was translated partly and is translated partly with the help of Rigvedic dictionaries. It's so close that even part of sentences are the same in the Avesta and in the Rigveda. And some of these sentences can be found also in old Greek poetry and even in Hittite poetry, but never so close as between the parallels between the Avesta and the Rig Veda. So they tell that the Avestic language and the Rig Vedic language are only two variants, two dialects of the same language. That's why my colleague Kellens asked his chair to be called Étude Indo-Iranienne, something like that. Going back to the history of the text of the Avesta and the Rig Vedic, they believe that it's not demonstrated, but it's a very nice hypothesis that the separation of the Indo-European groups, which we call now Iranian and Indo-Aryan, took place around 2000 BC, probably somewhere in the north of Marian. And that the nucleus of some Avestic and Rig Vedic hymns goes back to that time. In other words, many Rig Vedic hymns were created during the second millennium BC before being collected into a Samhita. That's Rig Veda Samhita, means a collection of Rig Vedic hymns, and they were fixed only around 1000 BC. That these dates are quite tentative, but still they make sense when you look at all the evidence. If it is so, how to explain that the Iranian religion, which is reconstructed from the oldest part of the Avesta, that means the Gatha and the Yasna Aptan Haiti, and the Vedic religion, which we reconstruct from the Rig Veda, can we explain that they are so close for the language and the wording, and so different, because there is almost nothing common between the Rig Vedic religion and the Avestic religion as we reconstruct it. Most handbooks now assume and assert that the discrepancy results from change brought by Zarathustra, called in Europe Zoroaster, change which are so important that they deserve to be called a revolution. It now appears to most younger scholars, and probably most scholars who are following Hoffman, that Zoroaster is a mythic person. What my colleague Kellen teaches. Zoroaster never existed. It is a mythic person. And that in some respect, the Gatha and Yasna Aptanhaiti of the Avesta are much more archaic than the Rig Veda. If so, there is no reason to assume that the Avesta only is innovative. The Rig Veda also could be innovative, which would better explain the growing distance between Iranian and Indian religions. That puts in danger the conventional wisdom according to which the Rig Veda is so much conservative that it is the best source for reconstructing the Indo-Iranian undivided religions, things which most our Russian colleagues do. And the Rig Veda cannot be used or cannot be the main source to reconstruct the Indo-European mythology or ideology, as Dumézil used to do in that very chair, much more modest, because the building was much older, but that was what Dumézil talked here. So that would be indeed a revolution in all the history of the Indo-European, and we have to wait a number of years to see whether this hypothesis hold good or not. But without going so far, how can we still reconstruct the history of ancient India, in fact limited to ancient Punjab, in the second millennium, in the second half of the second millennium BC, if the Rig Veda is in part a Central Asiatic document and the idealized vision of people referring to a time much earlier? And the main problem for the community of scholars is, how will our Indian colleagues agree with a reconstruction so contrary both to Hindu views and to conventional wisdom? Ah ben ça va, il est 32, on s'arrête 5 minutes. Je vous remercie.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-2-france.fr.